Hotel in Hong Kong on Thursday, September 7th. It's Leonard Reed accepting an invitation to speak to a group of Australian delegates to the Mount Pelion Conference. And he's going to talk mainly about methods of introducing free enterprise, limited government concepts.
Let me begin by answering a question you raised in here. You said it is time for commerce and industry to call a halt to excessive government and clearly express views about where the line should be drawn. Well, let me give you my idea of where we should draw the line. What should government do and what should government not do? Now, you cannot possibly tell what government should or should not do unless you know what government is and what government is not. I've been saying for years that the essential nature of government is organized force. In other words, they issue edicts and there's a constabulary that backs them up. Force, huh? Mm-hmm. Okay, I've been saying so long that I thought it was original with me. Until one day one of my associates threw a book on my desk that thick, entitled The State, published in the year 1900, and the author of the book was Professor Woodrow Wilson. He got a bigger job later. Well, anyway, I've been saying that, so the old boy plagiarized Reed, don't you see? Because as you'll see as I go along. Well, once you understand what government is and what government is not, then in other words, it's a physical force. Constabulary is a physical force. And I can symbolize a physical force by this, a clenched fist. If you will find out what this physical force can and cannot do, you will know what government should and should not do. Not necessarily what it will or will not do, but we're talking about the ideal here. And, well, what can it do? I know what it can do. It can inhibit. It can restrain. It can prohibit. It can squelch. It can penalize, right? Now the next question, the logical question is, what should be squelched, penalized, and so forth? Well, the answer to that question comes clear and clean in your moral philosophies long before Christianity. But you should inhibit destructive actions. Predation, stealing, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not so forth and so on, steel and so forth. Okay, now that's all this force can do, and it can't even do that when it's doing this other stuff, as you know. Okay, what you must recognize is what this physical force cannot do. This physical force is not a creative force. The creative force in every single instance is a spiritual force, in the sense that an idea is spiritual, or a discovery, invention, think of that, intuitive flash, etc., etc. Everything by which we live shows forth in the spiritual before it manifests itself in the material. Example, take this thing here. This is absolutely inconceivable had not some cave dweller eons ago discovered how to harness fire, correct? Or take that jet plane you flew here on. That's inconceivable had not some Hindu 1,000 years ago invented the concept of zero. All modern chemistry, all modern physics and so forth would be utterly impossible if you had to do it with Roman numerals, correct? Mm-hmm. So how do I draw the line? Just as simple as falling off a log. I limit government to inhibiting the destructive actions of men, invoking a common justice, keeping the peace. And I leave all creative actions, without exception, education or whatever, to men acting freely, voluntarily, competitively, cooperatively, privately. That's how I draw the line. Huh? Want any questions on that?
I like it too much to question.
Okay. All right, now I'm going to get into another bit here. It has to do with methodology. If you want to work, effectively in this field, you must be consistent in your positions. In other words, don't leak, or as I say. I think I'll tell you a story. It's a true story. There are five characters in it, all of whom are here. But this is one evening, 9 years ago this month, in Caracas, and Sam Husbands in San Francisco had a little tipping party up in his room before the dinner. And present outside of Sam and myself were Joaquin Rigg from Madrid, the best man in Spain on her side of the fence. Manuel Ayala of Guatemala, the best in Latin America. And Max Soon of Austria, the best in all of Austria. Anyway, after a couple of these things, I made some kind of a free market affirmation.
A free market?
Affirmation. And Max said to me, Leonard, I take it from what you said you would not believe in the Vienna Opera state-owned. And I said, I would not. And it shocked him. He said, why, Leonard? And I made an explanation of why, you see. He said, well, I'll agree with you in principle, but... I said, well, if you agree with me in principle, Max, we have nothing more to talk about. Well, that ended it for the night. Next morning in the lobby of the hotel, he was there when I came down. He said, Leonard, I laid awake all night trying to thinking about what you said to me. And I still agree with you in principle, but I find that I'm so emotionally committed to the Vienna Opera. In this case, I have to make an exception. So when I got back home, I wrote a chapter in one of my books entitled Sinking in a Sea of Butts.
In a sea of
butts. Butts. Spelled B-U-T-S. Yeah. Anyway, that's my final conclusion was, watch your butts, buddy. Well, enough of that. Now, you can't possibly, there are very few people who recognize this, you can't possibly be consistent in your positions unless you're doing your reasoning logically and deductively from a basic premise, that is a fundamental point of reasoning. I realized this about 27 years ago, so I set out to get myself a basic premise, that is, and I think I did one thing right. I asked myself the hardest question I could think of, which was, what is man's earthly purpose? Well, I couldn't find any answer to that without bumping head-on into three of my, might not be yours, but my fundamental assumptions. My first assumption is that man did not create himself, for it's perfectly obvious that man knows practically nothing whatsoever about himself. So my first assumption is the primacy and supremacy of what I refer to as an infinite consciousness. Some people call it Jehovah, some call it God, and blah, blah, blah. But I call it infinite consciousness. My second assumption is also demonstrable, namely that it is possible, while it may be difficult, for man to gain in awareness, perception, consciousness. And my third assumption, I cannot demonstrate it, I only know it to be a truth, namely the immortality of the human consciousness, this earthly moment not being all there is to it. It's consciousness that survives. You want to read a book on it, I'll tell you what it is. Anyway, when I get through with all these assumptions, then what is man's earthly purpose? It is to see how close you can come during your mortal moment to expanding your own consciousness into a harmony with infinite consciousness. Or if you want to put it in lay terms, to see how close you can come to realizing those potentialities which are uniquely yours. We're all different, don't you see? Summarize, what is man's earthly purpose? It is growth, development, evolution, emergence, or a very expressive term is hatching. There was an old Greek philosopher by the name of Heraclitus who said, man is on earth as in an egg, which inspired C.S. Lewis to write, you can't go on being a good egg forever, you must either hatch or rot. Well, now there is your premise. Well, how do you use it? Well, you take anybody's idea, your own or anybody else's, stack it up against that premise, and if it's antagonistic to it, you're again it. But if, on the other hand, it is promotive of it, in harmony with it, you are in its favor. Now, if you have a sound premise, and if you're doing your reasoning logically and deductively from that premise, every one of your positions will be consistently sound. Now, this has proved to be of great value to me. For instance, I no longer argue with anybody. You can say to me, Leonard, I don't agree with you. My reply will be, I couldn't care less. But it has another value, too. I no longer discuss ideological or philosophical questions with anyone unless that person is seeking light from me or I from him, and that cuts out an awful lot of talk, doesn't it? Now, you guys asked me this morning. I wouldn't be here if you hadn't asked me. I wouldn't have asked you to be here. Well, I think I can give you a good idea as to whether or not you have a sound premise. Number one, if it does not require individual liberty, I think you better take another look. And number two, if you cannot stand up before God and man alike and pronounce your premise as proudly as I have mine this morning, again, I think you ought to take another look at it. Huh? I'll give you one more idea of the premise before we finish. A very wealthy and scholarly man in Indianapolis gave me a book. He was a great friend of mine. Leonard, you must read this book. Well, the title of the book itself would scare the devil out of you. The Foundations of the Metaphysics of Morals by this German philosopher Immanuel Kant. This guy was an absolute pro at being obscure. I read the book and didn't know what I'd read. So I threw it up in the library. 6 months later, I began writing a piece entitled Importance of the Premise. And on the second reading, the whole book tumbled into sense. And all Kant was talking about was importance of a premise. And he had some very nasty things to say about people who deign to talk in ideological and philosophical subjects unless they were doing their reasoning from a basic premise. I do not speak German, but the translator called them shallow pates, which is not exactly a complimentary word. Anyway, he had a premise, and his premise he called good will. Now, by will, he didn't mean what we usually mean as by goodwill. It had nothing to do with intentions. By will, he meant the individual's ability rationally to will his own actions. And you could apply the adjective good, now listen to this, only if you could apply the principle of universality to your ideas, don't you see? Well, I didn't know what that meant, the principle of universality. But I've learned over the years, if you lean up against the door long enough, it'll cave in. And I leaned up against that one long enough to cause it to cave in. So I'll give you an example of, on this business. Let's take Leonard Reed. Leonard Reed has a right to his life, his livelihood, his liberty. Is that good? Well, according to Kant, that is good. If you can concede that same right to every individual on the face of this earth, universality, don't you see? Now reverse it and watch it come through. Leonard Reed has the right to take the life, the livelihood, and the liberty of another. Is that good? That's good only if you can concede the right of murder, of theft, of enslavement to everybody else on earth. Can I do it? Ergo, it is not good. Huh? Well, can't you see how I like my premise better than Kant's? But I didn't go to school either. Anyway, can't you see how if you were using Kant's premise, never doing anything that you couldn't concede to everybody else on earth doing, you'd be in pretty good shape.
Very good shape.
Okay, well that's enough of the premise, huh? Now, when it comes to methodology, of course, in this lecture, I do these lectures to include all seminars with it. And it takes me about an hour to do it. And I have to have a great big blackboard because I use a lot of drawings. But what I do in these lectures is to make the point that this is not a numbers problem. If this were a numbers problem, getting 51% of the people to agree with us, I wouldn't spend a moment of my life in this work. It'd be so absurdly futile. And number two, this is not a selling problem, but it is a learning problem. That's what it is, and that's all it is. And what you must try to do is to see if you can get so good at this philosophy that other people will seek your tutorship. Don't try to sell anybody. I mean, that's like trying to sell the idea of creation to an atheist or something. I mean, it's impossible. Forget it. So what you do, in other words, this is purely a matter of self-improvement. Now, if this were a... maybe I can draw a little chart here to show what I mean. this is my book, The Point of Cure. It's a chapter in that book of mine, Love of Liberty. But here's this chart. Now this chart is similar to the statistician's normal curve, you know. If you can see this thing. You see, now, this is to symbolize, shall we say, the adult population in our country. So I'm going to divide it into segments. There's a little bit of a segment here. And here's a little bit of a segment here. Now, this little bit of a segment here is to symbolize the very few people who are real, true believers in socialism. Call it what you will. It's all the same kettle of fish. And, all right. And this one over here is to symbolize the very few of us in the world who have some understanding of and can explain the free market, private ownership, limited government philosophy with its moral and its spiritual antecedents. In between exist the countless millions who couldn't care less. These people in here may be great computer designers, or they may be great this or this or that, huh? But when it comes to this subject, they don't know any more about it than I know how to compose a grand opera, huh? And that's quite a ways off, in case you don't know. Now, the point is, these people in here do nothing in the world except lean toward one of these camps or the other. And today, in Australia, United States, every Hong Kong, every place on the face of the earth, they're leaning in that direction, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, but don't overlook the importance of these people. They're the ones who make the final decision. Now, all I'm trying to do is, in other words, if this is the way they've been leaning for the past few decades, they continue this way, we'll end up being like Red China or Russia, huh? That's what it is. So you see, there is an enormous responsibility devolving on the few of us who are fortunate enough to be over here in this game, don't you see? And so this is what we have to do is to cause it like that. They don't know. They won't know. But these people today, these millions who are following the lefty direction, they are unaware of it. And if we succeed over here, they'll be just as unaware. Huh? They'll lean toward this or that, that's all. But it depends on how well we do our work. Now, I try to say that this is not a numbers problem. Let me point out something to you. Every good movement on the face of the earth has been led by an infinitesimal minority. Go back 2,000 years, our perfect exemplar, Christ. How many helpers did he have? 12, and one of them was a bum. Anyway, go on to England following the Napoleonic Wars, when mercantilism presided. Well, mercantilism is the same thing as we have the welfare state and the planned economy, don't you see? And go on to the USA. The number of people who actually were the brains of our Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, were nothing but a handful. They follow that. This is a leadership problem. That's what it is, and that is all it is. Now, there are as many different levels of leadership as there different levels as there are persons among us. Last 2 minutes to talk about. So I'll confine myself to just three ascending levels of leadership. Take your choice as the one to which you aspire. The first level of leadership requires absolutely nothing of the individual except that he or she do no ideological wrong. That's all. In this first level of leadership, it does not require the individual that he or she be understand this philosophy. Well, you have to understand it, but this first level of leadership does not require that he or she be a creative thinker, writer, talker of it. Only do no ideological wrong. Well, you'd think that was quite simple, just to do no wrong or give any wrong any support. But based on my 45 years of experience in this field, there isn't as many as 1 in 10,000 who can get into this person. Do no ideological wrong or lend any support to it. You must know what an ideological wrong is. This thing here, socialism or communism, call it what you will. Go out and ask the people in your orbit, are you a socialist? You better get your hand up or you'll have to get sucked in the snoot, right? Mm. Now, but the person to do no ideological wrong must know what the ideological wrong is. And here's what it is, and this is all it is. It's a double-barreled definition, socialism, communism, call it what you will. It's a state ownership and control of the means of production. That is your planned economy. That's your interventionist stuff. And it is the state ownership and control of the results of production, which is your welfare state, don't you see? That's what it is, and that's all it is. Now, the person, in order to do no wrong, must not only be able to repeat that definition, but must be able to apprehend it clearly in his or her own mind, don't you see? And that's what it is, and that is all it is. But don't overlook the effects of individuals who do no wrong. It has an enormous radiating influence. Well, that's the first level of leadership. Now we come to the second level of leadership, which is something quite different. This level of leadership requires the individual that he or she be actually a creative thinker, writer, talker of this philosophy. This level of leadership requires the individual he or she give a pretty high priority to this subject among the other activities. This level of leadership requires the individual that he or she know the subject. Hmm? Now, when I say know the subject, that's more than first meets the eye. Let me give you an illustration. Can you remember when you were a child learning penmanship? You had to think your way around the letter A and the other letters of the alphabet. And in other words, you never knew it until you relegated those physical movements like you're doing right here, relegated them to the conditioned reflexes. The only thing you had to think about is what it is you want to write, huh? That's when you know. Or take driving an automobile. You don't know how to drive an automobile if you have to think when you do this or that to the wheel, or this or that to the accelerator or the brake. You don't know how to drive an automobile until you, again, relegated those physical movements, conditioned reflexes, and the only thing you have to think about is where it is you want to go and how not to get hit, huh? Or take playing the game of golf. I hate to admit this when nobody is on hand, but I don't know how to play golf. When I stand up at the tee, I have to think about my stance. I have to think about getting some of the weight on my heels. I have to think about flexing my knees. In my condition, I have to think about sucking in. I have to think about the straight left arm. I have to think about the grip. I have to think about the backswing. I have to think about the position of the club at the top of the backswing. I have to think about starting it slowly and speeding it up as it pushes the ball. I have to think about the follow-through. I have to think about not swaying. I have to think where it is I want the ball to go. And when I get through with all that damn thinking, I miss the ball. Now, the person who knows how to play golf, like Jack Nicklaus, for example, or some of the other boys we know of in the world, all they think about is where it is they want the ball to go. They've relegated all those physical movements, the conditioned reflexes, and all the thing they have to think about. Well, memory muscle is one English pro called it, muscle memory. And well, I got news for you, they do better than I do. Now, why am I giving you these illustrations? Just to make the point as to when you know this subject. You know this subject when you can explain the fallacies of socialism and the principles of freedom with the same ease that you can say 42 to what, 6 times 7. Well, I got news for you. There isn't any of us that work that well. But in other words, but that is the ideal, don't you see? Now, then there is a, in this second level of leadership, there's a comment I'd like to make about, you know, over the years, ever since we started FEE 32 years ago, I get letters from people, Leonard, the socialists are winning, we're losing, why don't you use their methods? Well, the point is that these poor people don't understand that you use different tactics to destroy a free society than you do to create a free society. That ought to be more or less obvious to anybody. Let's take an example of a low objective. See, suppose my objective is your demise. Ever stop and think of the low-grade methods I could use? Plunk, plunk, plunk. Well, let's move up a little bit higher in the hierarchy of values. My ambition is to make poets out of you. Well, this begins to get slightly absurd. Number one, I don't know anything about poetry myself, and number two, I don't know how many of you are potentially poets. But is it not perfectly obvious that were that my ambition, I would have to be a great poet or not a one of you to pay a damn bit of attention to me? Is that not right? Now we go up into the third category. This category, I don't know anything about it except its definition and a few of its imperatives. But this level of leadership requires of the individual that he achieve that degree of excellence which will cause others to seek his tutorship. That's what it is, and that's all it is. And I'm going to suggest to you there's no limits how far you can go in this tooting business. There was an old boy, St. Augustine, who wrote a book entitled, an autobiography entitled Confessions. He passed away nearly 16 centuries ago, and I'm reliably informed that that is the most widely purchased autobiography in the world today. In other words, people are still seeking the tutorship of that man, you see. And I'm not suggesting that any of us will get there, but that's what it is, and that's all it is. Now, when you get up into this level of leadership, you are in the highest hierarchy of value there is. This correlates with wisdom and understanding. And by the same token, the method must be commensurately as high. Now, what is this method? As I suggested to you, it's getting so good that others will seek your tutorship. It's a learning problem. You can't inject your idea into the head of another. If you folks haven't used or publicized or reprinted that piece by Elber J. Nock entitled Isaiah's Job, for goodness sakes, do it.
What is it?
Isaiah's Job. Well, in other words, Nock was an old friend of mine, one of the greatest thinkers and writers you ever knew. And I read this piece first in 1936. It appeared in the Atlantic Monthly, Isaiah's Job, before, but I've reprinted hundreds of thousands of copies of it. But it changed my life. Up until then, I was one of these guys who was going out and beating the hell out of people, you know, and calling the other side names and all that sort of stuff. And that was the thing that changed my life entirely. I don't do that at all. Isaiah's Job. And in other words, these people who count, you see, you don't know who they are. For instance, on this tour yesterday, I didn't get off of the bus because I'm not a tourist. I stayed on where it was air conditioned and so forth. And this little, Macau? We're up in Macau, you know. And this little stewardess or whatever you call her, she said, aren't you going down? I said, no. So she sat and talked with me for half an hour while all the people are out taking pictures and blah, blah, blah. And by golly, you would be amazed at the extent to which she is interested in this sort of thing. You never know. As the Bible says, out of the mouth of babes. I had a letter a while ago from a 10-year-old boy that was more brilliant on our philosophy than 99% of the business leaders in America could write. Huh? You never know. You never know. So, let's go back and show how this works when you achieve this excellence. I'll take you back to the golf course again. When I go out to my club, St. Andrews, the members out there do not say to me, Leonard, will you please show me how to swing a golf club? Why? Because by now they are aware of my incompetency as a golfer. But you wave a magic wand and let me be as good as Jack Nicklaus, huh? Or Gary Player, or whoever. Every member of that club will tag me around and they'll try to learn from me, will they not? For example, one of my hobbies over the years has been cooking. And let's suppose I couldn't scramble an egg. Would your wives ask me for recipes? I doubt it. But now make the assumption that I'm good as I really am. Then not only would, or as good as the great Escoffier, then not only would your wives, but all the aspiring chefs in the world would seek the tutorship. Is that not right? That's the way this thing works.
Sure.
And most of, you know, I'm... many of the members. The first best meeting we ever had in this society was 1947. There were just 36 of us. That was by far the best meeting. And it's been getting worse ever since. I mean, I hear a lot of, I may say so, crap over here. And I think I know the reasons, but I don't want to bore you with that. But so many of these people are agnostics or atheists. They don't say it, but you can tell them what they say that they are. They are not doing their reasoning, their actions from a basic premise. Name one of them that is. Huh? Well, I have a lot of fun in this business. One of the things is this. I've been in this business so long that I've seen a great number of flip-flops, that is. I've seen out-and-out communists turn out to be some of the best people on our side of the fence.
Yeah.
I have. And you never know where they are. I have a rule that I try to follow. Go only where you are called. But do everything in your power to qualify to be called. If I hadn't done any homework on this thing, you wouldn't have invited me here this morning. Is that not right? We in our foundation, we use this principle all the way through. We never put anybody on earth on the mailing list unless they request it, or unless you take the responsibility and tell us to do it and pay for it, huh? Mm. But if your name is used, we won't put anybody on. We even use that in raising more money. I don't ask anybody for a nickel. Are we doing all right? Pretty good.
Leonard, may I ask a question?
Oh, of course.
You mentioned this philosopher 16 centuries ago, and his autobiography is very well read. What is the name of that book? Is it available?
You mean Immanuel Kant's The Foundations of the Metaphysics of Morals?
No. You said
St. Augustine.
Entitled Confessions.
Oh, yes.
Yep. And where you get it? I haven't the slightest idea.
Any bookstore.
I think any bookstore.
Who wrote it?
Hmm? Augustine. Augustine, I can't. Different Catholics pronounce it a different way, and I'm not a Catholic. But
do you think it's worth reading?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. It's one of the books you should read. There are quite a few books.
I would imagine it would be a most popular library.
Oh, I would think so. Well, certainly it would be in a Catholic church library.
You've mentioned that there are quite a few books we should read. Some of us, not all of us, but to a greater or a lesser degree, good students. I've got a great leaning to Ludwig von Mises' work, as well as Professor Hayek's work.
He was on our payroll from the day we started C 32 years ago, but he died. And I would have disagreement with Mises on some things, that he's one of the greatest on this philosophy that ever lived, you know. And of course, his greatest book and the most difficult to read is Human Action. that would not have been brought out had I not given the Yale University Press a check for $7,500 for that many copies of the book at the wholesale price. And I got them out of their manufacturing costs and brought it out. And I'll tell you a story about how difficult it is. I was out in Los Angeles, or suburb of Los Angeles, with my friends, the Ingebretsons. He was the only one that ever graduated with straight A's at Stanford Law School, very brilliant fellow. His wife was one of my favorites. Anyway, this is October 1949. I was explaining how difficult Mises was. No one had seen the book. And to make my point, I turned to the beautiful Dorothy, and I asked her a question using a chapter heading in the book. I said, "Dorothy, dear, how would you like to indulge with me in the praxeological aspects of polyogism?" Dorothy looked up and said, "Len, would it hurt?" Well, he has written some other books, though, that are quite simple. That's all on our literature freedom list. When you're talking about books, see, we have 125 books in this literature freedom now. It's the best freedom library in the world, without question. The best starter offer books. I don't know how this would work in another country, but in the United States, the best starter offer book is Weaver's Mainspring of Human Progress. But it does discuss the principles, don't you see?
Yes,
you know it. All right. And then I would put in as the next best book, not best, but Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson is good. And one of my favorites of all time is Frederick Bastiat's The Law.
Right.
And that's 79 pages of just pure stuff. He was a great man. But you can go on up to, well, all sorts of them. Maybe I, well, here's another point that I'd like to make. Being in this business all these years, I've seen a great number of people after a seminar. Boy, they're turned on. And what they do, they go out the next morning and try to set their dumb friends straight. Well, I got news for them. Their dumb friends run around the corner when they see them coming, and their dumb friends don't invite them to dinner anymore, and that's expensive. So, now, what is the right method? Well,
this is just so true.
The right method is to share your ideas with others, as distinguished from ramming it down their neck. The more you share your ideas with others, assuming they're interested, the better and higher grade will your own ideas be. And that's fairly plain why that's true. When you are, in other words, as I said a moment ago, go only where you're called, but do everything in your power to qualify to be called, don't you see? And when you're called, they're listening. And the more ideas you have, in other words, when I refer to calls, I mean when they're seeking your tutorship. But it's easy to see why it is. The more you share, the more you receive. You're going to make a speech, or you're going to write a book. Share, huh? What do you not put your best foot forward? This is what you do, don't you see? Well, that's when you are at your best. You know, I ride about 100,000 miles a year on airplanes. There's always someone sitting here at my left, literally and figuratively. I don't know who the person is, but I know how to start a conversation with this person, so we cannot help but say in about 2 minutes, "Mr. Reed, what the hell do you do?" You see, I've been told. Well, then I know how to respond, so I can tell whether there's any interest or not. and it doesn't always work. I don't know if this will mean anything to you or not, but I was flying out to Chicago one day from New York, and here was a guy I was up in first class sitting on my left. About 30 minutes from touchdown, I began this routine of mine, you see, which is to actually, it's to start a conversation, never finish it. I was having lunch, this is a true story, several weeks ago in Hong Kong with Henry Speary, head of the First National Bank, and stop. And I was playing golf at Ligonier with Arne Palmer last week, and just and shut up and just go on with a lot of things. Well, you know, everybody tries to pigeonhole you, you see, and so by 2 minutes, their curiosity bursts. You see, what the hell do you do? You see, I've been called. It's kind of funny, but well, that's the way this thing works. Maybe I've seen you before.
Yes, sir. Reporting for duty.
Okay. I'll show you how it works. Oh, this is about 20 years ago. I wrote a piece entitled "There's No Moral Right to Strike." And it went out to the 50,000 people on our mailing list. In about 3 weeks, I received on the letterhead of the Sailors Union of the Pacific, that's one of Harry Bridges' outfits, of which there ain't no butcher. And the writer of the letter was William Benz, organizer, meaning a strike organizer. 3 pages of just pure vitriol. You dirty SOB, but he didn't want to spell it, there's an A in it. But I'll say one thing, it had a lot of spirit in it. So instead of throwing it in the wastebasket, as you might be prone to do, I called in my associate, Reverend Edmund Opitz. I said, Eddie, I'm going to be away for 3 days. And what I'd like you to do is to write this gent a letter using our method. Well, I'll tell you what our method is. Our method is that of turning the other cheek. In other words, write the guy as high grade a letter as you'd write the Lord, huh? Well, Reverend Hope is pretty good at that. When I came back from this 3 days, it was absolutely beautiful. And I sent it to this guy, the SOB guy, he said. And as fast as an airmail letter could go to Portland, Oregon, and back again, I received the most abject apology I have ever read in my life. He was absolutely crushed to think that he'd written his kind of a letter to the kind of a person Opitz had made me out to be, you see. And, well, and that was, so I responded and thanked him, and I sent him a couple of books, Harper's Why Wages Rise, and a couple of my Argentine lectures, Why Not Try Freedom. And pretty soon I got a letter from him. He said, this is the best stuff I've ever read in my life. Please send me more. It was getting kind of fun from a guy like that, so I sent him about a half a dozen books. Hope he says, if you want to get some free literature, right, read a nasty letter. after he'd read these, he wrote me, now imagine what he wrote me. Mr. Reed, I hereby make you my director of reading. I authorize you to purchase any book at any time which in your judgment will help me with my thinking, and send me the bill. Did you ever hear of a turnaround like that in your life?
Well, if you can win them like that, it's nice.
That's fantastic. Well, anyway, we had a lot of fun. So, our correspondence, I never had more wonderful correspondence with a guy than I did with this fellow. And about 6 months after this first event, I had the occasion to go to Portland. And I wrote him a letter and I said, I'd like to meet you. Personally, I'm writing the Arlington Republic at midnight. How about meeting me Monday morning? And Monday morning, there he was, great big fellow. Obviously a lot of energy, 47, 48 years old. And we went up to the breakfast table and sat down. And he made several confessions to me. Number one, he never quite finished the second grade. And number one, two, until he met us, Fee, our works, every moment of his life had been lived in hate. Then he caught me looking at his right hand, and a finger was off. Let's show you the kind of life he did. His finger was off right down to here. He said, oh, that, got in a fight on shipboard, and the son of a bitch beat it off. I mean, that was kind of a life he lived. Well, anyway, went to luncheon that day, and I had to make a speech. He went with me and brought another labor official. When it was over, he said, "May I drive you to the airport? I don't destroy generous impulses." So I said yes. And so I thought I'd have a little fun on the way to the airport. By this time, I was calling him by his nickname, Whitey. And I said, "Whitey, you remember that first letter you wrote me? I'll bet it was the first time in his life he ever blushed." And he said, humbly, "Yes, I remember." I said, "Whitey, suppose that I had replied in kind. Would we be writing together?" Of course, right then he imagined me calling him, and I said, "We don't." He said, "I'll say we wouldn't." His whole anger came back. I said, "Whitey, I want to show you what I did to you, that you may do to others." And with that, I took my airplane ticket out of my pocket, and I held it up against the windshield. I said, "Whitey, what holds it there?" And he said, "It's the tension of your finger." I said, "You are right. Now, I want you to watch what happens when I remove the tension." Took the finger off, the thing came down, didn't it? Then I cited him an old Arab proverb. "He who strikes the second blow starts the fight." "Whitey, you struck the first blow. I did not strike the second. You and I are buddies." And he got the point. And this correspondence went on all for another year or two. And then all of a sudden, bang. I thought he'd defected. In about 3 months, I get a letter from him. "Mr. Reed, I never thought it would happen to me, but I bought a new car and I was out in the headway, on the highway, and I had a head on. And I've been in this hospital now for 3 months with these doctors trying to splice me together again. And, but Leonard, or Mr. Reed," he didn't call me Leonard, "Mr. Reed, you should see what I have done on behalf of our philosophy with these MDs." Now, you've got there a real story. Suppose we had no books, no ideas, huh? Could we turn that man's life around? Well, if what we did is right, that's right for your organization. I'd rather put it another way. It's right for each of you. Hmm? Individuals. Well, I guess
that's on our week seminar.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you very much, sir.
You know them? Yeah. Run, run.
Reggie.
Yeah.
Yeah, great.
Yeah,
I haven't seen it since
they came back. I think they're...
Oh,
they are back now.
Ron.
Yes, yes. Especially
too. Let me show you here. What did I do with it?
Yeah.
There you go.